How would you describe yourself?
I don't know. I guess I walk along the edge. But being on that edge, where you have to see where you're going and you have to be careful because the wind is tossing and turning you, it's still the most exciting place to be. And you can fall, and I have. Or other people can push you, and they have. But at the same time, if you know what moves you, and for me it's never been money. I'm very lucky that The Lion King is successful. If it wasn't, I'd be as poor as you, the poorest. I would be, because the projects that I want to do are still on the edge. I've been offered some normal stuff. I'm not really interested. So I would say that I'm not trying to brag about on the edge. I'm saying it's not always a great place to be, but it is a place that I would rather live than on flat, boring ground.
Julie Taymor is a director, a designer, and a puppet and mask maker. She works in theater, in opera, and in movies, but she is for sure best known as the visionary who took the story of The Lion King as it was told in the Disney animation and turned it into a miraculous piece of theater. During these difficult days, you may not be able to see a Broadway show or attend any cultural event for that matter, but we thought we could at least give you a peek into one of the most fascinating, intense artistic minds of our era. Julie Taymor is on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Julie Taymor has done two interviews with the Academy of Achievement, and you'll hear excerpts from both in this episode. One was recorded in 2006, on the same weekend she was premiering an opera called Grendel, and working on her movie Across the Universe, a musical about the 1960s. The second interview was in 2019, as she was finishing a film called The Glorias, about the life of Gloria Steinem. She did lots of other work in the intervening 13 years between our interviews, and all throughout, The Lion King remained an ongoing international phenomenon. It's a rare thing for a director to work successfully across so many platforms, but Julie Taymor is a rare being.
One of the things why I love to jump back and forth in the mediums is film does allow me to be more literal. I can go to the real place. I can go to the Coliseum, and I don't have to fake it. And I can go to an Eskimo snowfield if I want to have an Eskimo snow. I don't need to do chicken feathers falling out of a plate. And when I was thinking about The Lion King, I said, well, whatever it is, it has to do with theater does best. And what theater does best is to be abstract and not to do literal reality. So, for instance, you listen to Jeremy Irons in the guise of this animated lion, and you go, my God, that animated lion is so human.
What will your mother think?
Look at how human the features are. So how do I get that human, and also, because the humanity of the Lion King is its power, not its animals, its humanity of the movie. And I thought, well, if I cover the human with the mask, I won't get that part of the humanity. So let's have the human, and then let's have the mask be the symbol of the animal. And as a sculptor, you have to abstract the essence. It's called an ideograph. You have to abstract the essence of the character into a few brush strokes or a few carving strokes. So Scar is very, because he's serpentine and he's off-center and he's crooked, you make a face that's not symmetrical. Whereas Mufasa is he's the salt of the earth, he's the earth, he's the sun king, he's the sun. So you have these big circles. And my job as a director and as a designer is to do that kind of abstraction. And to say it in a few, with a few brushstrokes. Like if you look at the scene, act two, it begins with a drought. Now, I could have green trees with leaves falling off, drying up, but wouldn't a film do that better? And an animated film even better, because they can make it any way they want? So I say, what in the most simplest terms, with the most simplest theatrical idea, technique, can I say it? And it was a big white circle of cloth, of silk, with blue lines on it that was pulled through a hole in the floor. And all you saw was that circle, which was also the circle of life, was also the circle of Mufasa, is the main element in the entire, it's the main symbol is the circle. You watch this water, but it's just silk, disappear through a hole. Film can't do that. Theater is far superior to film in poetry. In abstract poetry. That doesn't mean there aren't some films that are very theatrical and abstract, but in general, when we like our films, whether it's, you know, the reality of the Titanic, ooh, I could see it was blue screen or whatever, you know, when you're trying to make those visual effects real, the audience wants to believe it. They want to believe those things. And in theater, they jump with you. They're transported. They know that that's just a piece of fabric on a stage, or that sun is just sticks, bamboo sticks with fabric hanging and a bunch of strings. But when you bring that sun up with those invisible but visible wires, the audience is moved because they fill in the blanks. They are there as participants. They are there to fill out the rest of the sentence. You don't patronize your audience with reality. Oh, we could do a sunset with a projection. No, why would you do that? That's not what you want. You want to say, if I were to create one of those suns that are on the desert with those lines that shimmer, how do I do it with just silk and sticks? And that's why I do theater. And in film, film is expected to be more real. You know, when you, in Across the Universe, we shot everything in New York City, but we shot Vietnam, Washington, D.C., Detroit, but we really were trying to make it look like Vietnam when we went to New Jersey into the swamps. We brought our palm trees. You know, we weren't just suggesting that it was Vietnam. We were really trying to create that visceral reality there. And even Titus, a film like Titus with Anthony Hopkins, is a movie. We shot in Colosseums, on locations. Of course, it was theatrical because I played with mixing, blending of time. But in theater, you can be much more abstract and simple and be suggestive. When we do the savannah in The Lion King, people walk with platters of grass on their heads, and the audience gets it.
Gets that it's a field swaying with the breeze.
Now, I enjoy doing both. I enjoy moving back and forth because each medium challenges me with their own rules. And I love, what I don't have in theater is editing. Like, I would love my transitions to go like that. Instead, I have to wait for the mountain to turn. Whereas in film, you can really play with how you tell the story through the cutting. The editing is, transitions in both forms are important, but they're the opposite. They work in the opposite way. A lot of what I do in theater is cinematic, and a lot of what I do in film is theatrical. But there are different rules to it. What I mean by that is I use perspective in theater. I'll go do a long shot with the little miniature puppet of the animals on walking through the grass, and then all of a sudden the life-size person will come forward. And you've made that change from the long shot to the close-up. And you accept it through a technique change. But in film, obviously, it's simple and easy to go to do those changes. But each art form makes me more interesting in the other art form because I try and bring in those techniques and those ideas and put them into a different way of using them.
Julie Taymor gives her parents a lot of the credit for helping her develop such an open, full-throttle approach to her art. They weren't artists themselves. Her father was a gynecologist, her mother a political activist. But if there's one word she uses to summarize her childhood, it is freedom. Her parents gave her lots of it.
in those days, yeah, there was television, there was this and that, but we put on plays in the backyard, in the garage. We had dress-up boxes with clothes. And then finally, when I was around 8 or 9 years old, I said, I want to go and join the Boston Children's Theater. So every day after school, I would get on the T and go downtown by myself and acted and took classes. And I was the youngest of three kids, by a lot, by 6 or 7 years. And my parents let me be free. I traveled when I was 15 to Sri Lanka. It was Ceylon at the time. I've been many places. For me, travel was my education, and going out doing theater in Boston it took me out of my suburban neighborhood and brought me to kids who were from Dorchester or South Boston, mixture of races, mixture of economic levels. So it's not just the theater itself, it's the experience of doing the theater.
Those trips to downtown Boston and that summer program in Sri Lanka launched the lifelong fascination with other cultures that would become part of her artistic core. She did pause long enough to go to college at Oberlin in Ohio. She didn't study theater there, as she told the Washington Post's Mary Jordan in this interview for the Academy of Achievement, but she continued to put on plays.
I didn't want to be a director. I just became a director. I wanted to study anthropology. I studied with Margaret Mead in Columbia.
What does that mean? I didn't want to. I became it.
I didn't set my idea. Oh, what are you going to be when you grow up? I'm going to be a director. I never thought about being a director. I just had stories to tell. I just started directing.
And that happened, you were in your 20s?
Younger, probably. But in Oberlin, I started directing original work. I was acting. And I acted in New York professionally. But the thing is that when I was 20 or 19 acting, I couldn't stand that I couldn't play character roles, that I had to be the pretty young ingenue. That's not who I really was. I was probably the Wicked Witch of the West, you know? I was like, I would rather be, you know, this or that, but your physicality determines when you're an actor a lot of what you can do.
Do you think you were meant to be a director?
I don't think in things like that. I don't think of things as meant. Who meant it? God? Who meant my mama? But I think I was always directing. I was always putting on shows. I didn't like dolls, but I did have puppets, and I did put on the shows in the backyard, as I said. So I was always a director. I just did it. I never studied theater. I was in theater. And after a while, the lack of control as an actor just wasn't for me.
When Julie Taymor graduated from Oberlin, she got a fellowship, a Watson Fellowship, to study puppet theater in different parts of the world. She was supposed to spend 3 months of her time in Indonesia, but that turned into 4 transformative years. Theater, music, and dance were so much part of the very essence of everyday life and religion there. There weren't even words for them. And that filled 22-year-old Julie Taymor with awe.
I stayed to start my own theater company. And in this hiatus, while I was pulling together the performers, I traveled to an incredible ceremony on the rim of a lake, a crater lake, a volcanic, living volcano. I've got the scars to prove that carved out my leg. This little village called Trunyan was having an initiation ceremony where all these various villages would come to initiate the young men into their manhood, 13, 14-year-old, like many ceremonies. And I was there with another performer, and we split up, and I came into this village square, this temple square, in the dark. I was tired, sat under this banyan tree with its roots hanging into the earth, under a full moon, no electricity in this village, of course. And I watched as, out of the darkness, with no audience around, and they couldn't see me, I was in the shadows, 20 or 30 old men in full warrior Baris costume, with all the little mirrors and the spears, came out and danced this incredible dance in the darkness. And I was squinting my eyes and seeing the light bounce off these mirrors. And as these voices rose out of these old men, and they stood up straight, these bent old men stood up straight for this eternity, which was a half an hour or so, and these sounds came out of their mouths. I watched in complete wonder, wondering, who were they dancing for? My God, in my culture, if there's not an audience and a paying audience, you don't do it. If there's nobody to see it, why would you do it? And yet they were performing, singing, dancing for this time for what I would say is what really is God, and that is for a principle other than themselves, for something that is larger, whether it's to pay back nature or to say, I'm doing this because I have to do it, because it's part of me to... They probably do it because they don't know why, ultimately. They do it out of tradition. But where these traditions come from, and the fact that it was done so perfectly without the critic being there, without the applause, was really moving to me at age 22. And right after they danced and then bent over again and walked out of the arena, a young man with a propane lantern came on and set up a couple of propane lanterns to light up the space. A curtain was put up, and it filled with an audience of all-age people for the next 9 hours to see a human drama, an Arjuna, an opera. And those people needed the light, because these performers were performing for human beings. But something else there didn't need the artificial light. It needed a light that came from inside. And it's something that is probably the most important moment of my life, to go back and understand, especially when I'm having trouble, like I've had all week with this bloody set, of why am I doing this? I didn't have to do this opera. I can make movies, I can make money in Broadway theater. I'm doing it because I love the art form. And therefore, at some point, you put those blinders on, you say, okay, it's not working now, but I knew I had a vision there. Let's just keep on that track.
In addition to opening her eyes to what sheer devotion to art looks like, Indonesia and Japan also provided Julie Taymor with a grounding in the power of puppetry. She doesn't use puppets in all her theater work, but if you've seen The Lion King on stage, and there's a good chance you have, you will understand what I mean by the power of puppetry.
You know, we still hear the word puppet and we get this nauseating image of some kind of Muppet or something, and puppets really are the origins of theater. There are even shadows on the wall, and Plato's cave was a puppet. So, you know, the very first actor was some kind of hand creating some kind of animal. And the making of the mask, or the making of the puppet in Indonesia, the carving of the leather shadow puppet, is such a high art form that a wooden mask, you have to hold the head to north and the south would be the bottom. How you put the masks in a box, how you treat them. They're not merchandise. They're not just inanimate objects. The wood, the tree, if the tree, the grains go from north to south to the roots, then you carve that mask that way. Now, people make up these rules, but somehow they're not God-given, because there's no such thing. But somehow these rules that come from nature, when I was talking about awe earlier, they are things that bring the level of our humanity to another place. We can either be monsters or angels. We are able to be, or demons and angels, as that book says, we are able to be incredibly creative or to be incredibly destructive. And we have that decision to make.
We know which path Julie Taymor chose. She's careful to point out that she never professes to be a practitioner of Indonesian puppetry or Japanese puppetry. Those are lifelong practices specific to their cultures. But they have inspired her and become woven into the fabric of her own artistry. And she's found ways through significant risk-taking to make them create that sense of awe in our own culture and in other cultures too.
How many people do you think have seen your version of The Lion King?
90 million, over
90 million people.
In every continent but Antarctica.
So you were not that well known when you took on that project.
No.
She had directed some successful plays in New York, including some Shakespeare with puppets. And she had directed a spectacular production of Stravinsky's opera Oedipus Rex, also with puppets, and the fabulous Jesse Norman, who we also have a podcast episode about, and which you should listen to after this one. But what Julie Taymor had in spades, what she was hired for, was her experimental artistry and her bravery. There were massive wild animals and stampedes central to the Lion King, for goodness sake. A conventional approach was not going to work.
If you don't challenge yourself and risk failing, it's not interesting. I
I think, you know, this is a story that was told many times with The Lion King, but when I first created this concept, none of that brass at Disney, except for the producer, Tom Schumacher, and one other, Peter Schneider, really believed in it. So I said, fine, if you don't believe that you can create this dual event, you know, where you have the human and the animal simultaneously, give me the money to do it properly and I'll do a workshop and I'll do three different kinds. I'll do my original concept, I'll do makeup, and I'll do a mask, because I've got nothing to prove. I just believe that this is the right technique for telling this story. And when we finished, every one of the techniques worked, which of course they would, because Peking opera works and kabuki theater works and Javanese shadow puppetry works. And what Michael Eisner said, God bless his soul, he said, well, they all work, and your original idea, I think we should go with, because it's the most risky, and therefore, the payoff, if it works, will be the biggest. So the point is that they didn't do the safe thing. Even hiring me wasn't the safe thing. It was an interesting, potentially interesting. I'd never done a commercial hit before, a Broadway show. But there was a sense that I had a way to tell this story, and they trusted me. They let me, as an artist, do it. And they supported me, and I've had that rarely.
How many years of your life do you think you spent on The Lion King?
Well, Lion King probably was 2 or 3 to create it. And it's been 22 years now since it opened on Broadway, and I've done a lot of the casting and then a lot of rehearsals around the world for the many other productions. We have one that's from Africa now, which I cast in all parts of Africa, especially South Africa, that's been touring Southeast Asia. I did it in Mandarin in China, in Shanghai. We have one in Spain that's been there for years, 2 in Great Britain. We did one in Brazil, in Mexico, 2 in Australia, France. You know, they've been pretty much all over the place.
You know, a lot is often lost in translation, any translation. Are there any special challenges when you're trying to bring, you know, The Lion King to different cultures?
Well, I'm very attentive to what are some of the especially humor. Humor does not transcend. So when you get in there and you have the hyenas or Timon and Pumbaa, you have to find what the local humor is. And you have to find, and sometimes it's politically incorrect, but I don't care. That's what life's about. That's what humor is about. So you have to find, well, who hates who in which society, and who mocks who. And you play with that. And by making it personal to the people you're performing for, they own it. We have 2 companies in Japan for 21 years in Japanese. And that has to have, like, Osaka as opposed to Tokyo. Who are the outsiders? Who are the bad guys? Who are the dum-dums? You know, it depends. If you're in Osaka, it's going to be the Tokyos. If you're in the Tokyos, it's going to be the guys from Osaka. So I think it's and same with Beijing and Shanghai. It was very funny because you have to use accents. And you know how accents just, we have feelings about dialects and accents. So it was very, very powerful.
Did the success of The Lion King, I mean, it was, maybe it still is, the highest grossing production mounted on Broadway?
As women, we really rarely do this. It's not that. It's the most successful entertainment in the history of all entertainment, including movies, more than Star Wars. People don't know that. I mean, it actually is.
How did that change you? What a statement to say.
Well, that doesn't change. Well, it's kind of an odd statement to make, but you brought it up. So, you know, men are much easier at saying things like that.
I think it's great. We have been told,
you know, modesty is virtuous and all that stuff.
But say that again.
It's a fact that it is the most successful entertainment of all entertainments in the history of all entertainments. Yes, yeah. Every place we've been, it's a prodigal son coming of age story. We're humans. We all go through it. But I don't want to just talk about Lion King, because that was 20 years ago. I mean, I'm doing a Gloria Steinem movie right now.
And we want to talk about that. But, you know, people often say that when something goes wrong, you learn more from it.
Yes.
And I think the people listening here love to hear how people get past things that go wrong. So the Spider-Man was not fun.
I haven't actually talked about Spider-Man publicly, and I'm not sure when that will change.
That was Mary Jordan trying to put it delicately. And if you don't know what she's referring to, the full title of the Broadway show was Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, with music and lyrics by Bono and The Edge from the band U2. For the story, Julie Taymor wove together elements of the movie version of Spider-Man with elements of the myth of Arachne. 10 years ago, it was one of the most talked about perfect storms of trouble ever to hit Broadway. It was the most expensive production ever. It had the most delays and the longest run of preview performances ever, 182, before it finally opened. It was the most technically complex and ambitious ever, with aerial combat over the audience. Actors were injured badly. In the end, Julie Taymor was fired and blamed for the fiasco. She was even mocked on Saturday Night Live. The musical was significantly reworked and rewritten before it opened officially. It left scars that she says are simply part of her now.
There's a lot to say about what happened. I think it was a magnificent piece of theater that didn't get finished, that we weren't allowed to finish. And I'll be very brief about this. And what happened is even Lion King, I had a great team. I had Disney supporting me. It was experimental. Spider-Man started out, first of all, it took too long, and we went through the crisis of the money falling out and different producers. So it didn't have the people who started it weren't the people there. So we didn't actually have a good core team, and the people who ended up producing and working on it, they'd never done Broadway. They choked. It's as simple
as that. Was Bono and Edge working on that?
They weren't there when they should have been, they were halfway, and because of the way it lasted. I think that script, if you ever want to see something really incredible, that script is about fake news. In 2002 is when I came up with the concept of it. It was based on 40 years of comic books. It was to be the Uber story. It was very ambitious. You could say that it's about hubris, and I would have been attacked for hubris, thinking that I could actually pull this thing off. But I think that I still think it's one of the reasons I'm doing the Gloria Steinem is she called me up and she had seen the version that wasn't finished, and she was so blown away by it. She didn't know about the controversy, and she called me and said, "This is extraordinary." But that was a runaway train where there was blood in the water, too big a names. People like to knock you down, you know, with the success of Lion King.
And they said it was too costly. There were some injuries.
No, costly.
You got fired.
Injuries weren't that's not me. There's injuries in theater all the time, in ballet and theater. But the cost, this is the funny thing about cost of theater. You could see a two-character play on Broadway for $150 a ticket, where they have two actors in one set, and it still costs that money. Or you could see for $70 a musical that employs more people. Where's the money going? It's going to people. You're paying designers and craftsmen and choreographers and dancers. So I've never understood that mentality. And, you know, it's certainly at this point, nobody thinks about it. Lion King was almost the same price. They also didn't get the truth. No journalist ever investigated what really went on. And I'm not going to tell you now, but
can you tell us a little of the truth?
No, not for this.
Do you think that?
No, because it's really dark. It's dark. No, I don't think so.
What did you learn from this dark episode?
That you have to have your collaborators, that all the people have to be on the same wavelength. And when it gets rough, you have to stick with it if you believe in where you were going. See, I think that when we had rough times on Lion King, where people didn't believe that the puppets and masks would work, my major producers stood by it and believed in it. What happened to me and my choreographer is we became scapegoats and were isolated. And they decided to go for the easier thing and give up. The rest of them, they went for the Spider-Man 1 or whatever. They gave up on the larger story and the more exciting and risky. They got scared.
There's so many times I've heard that somebody will, whether it's a book or a play or a theater production, where the critic pans it, but the audience loves it.
Yeah.
Right? For yeah. films, too.
Yes. Oh, completely.
So you must have seen that.
Oh, no,
many
I've been
times.
Through that in films, definitely. You know, where you have to fight for what you were working on. Across the Universe was one of those, the Beatles musical. They loved it at Sony, but they smelled the money. It's not that it wasn't working. This is a different thing. They smelled the money and thought if we got rid of the politics, the black people, the homosexuality, and too much art, we could have High School Musical, pre-High School Musical. Meaning, like, won't we? It's that mentality that if it's got too much of that, maybe we won't reach the young. I said, this is the Beatles. We're trying to reach 12-year-olds to 80-year-olds. They each will find, like the Lion King, you find where you hook in. You don't patronize your audience. Little children love The Lion King, and when they see these white streamers coming out, they kind of get that that's tears, but the adults see the poetry, that you're using silk to represent tears. So I believe that you can create popular art and still be artistic, be commercial, but have it on multiple levels be appreciated. It's like somebody said, a wonderful artist said, you know, you have a building with 15 floors. You should be able to get off on any floor in that building and still go to the top.
Julie Taymor told Mary that she has many of her best ideas in that twilight period between being asleep and awake. Others often come when she's traveling.
I want you. I want you so bad.
I remember years ago in Mexico, walking down the beach when I was working on Across the Universe, the Beatles musical. And I was walking in the sand and I was thinking about the one song, I Want You, which I don't know if you saw it. Did you ever see it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. The idea for carrying the Statue of Liberty across the villages and the jungles of Vietnam came from that walk on the beach, because I thought of, I don't know, for some reason I was reminded of the pyramids of Egypt and the slaves carrying. And I had done a piece at the Public Theater years ago called the Haggadah, where I literally carried, had this, the it was the Haggadah was the story, you know, the Jews coming out and working on going through the Red Sea. And I created this moment where the dancers and actors were carrying pyramids made of matzah. And I was reminded of that when I was in the sand again. And I thought, and I was seeing the palm trees in Tulum in Mexico. And so I came up with the idea, okay, we're going to carry the Statue of Liberty. And then so that scene came from that walk. And there's been other ones for Grounded, when I did the drone story, Grounded at the Public. It's that same beach. So that same beach has been a fertile beach for me.
How often do you go back to that beach?
Every year I go there. I do think walks and being outside, nature is an incredible place. You know, it's a meditation. Talking to people is inspiring. A lot of my ideas come when I'm talking to someone, trying to explain a story, and then an idea will come while I'm talking.
Sometimes the development of those ideas takes a long time, and sometimes no time at all.
There's no rhyme or reason. There's none. Like in a film situation, I wanted to do the Gloria Steinem book, My Life on the Road. If the producers who put the money in, you can't find them in Hollywood, it will take a long time. That doesn't mean I didn't have the idea for it very quickly, the idea of how to do it. You know, we got the rights, we got Gloria behind it, all of the Julianne Moore signed on you, all those things were very quick. But then there's the, it's not a normal Hollywood film, it's a road picture about women, meetings with remarkable women. It's unusual, it's the second wave of feminism. Have you ever seen a movie about that? Never. You know, so that even though we had big stars in it, and Gloria is in it and is executive producing, and it's still gonna be hard.
During this interview in the fall of 2019, Julie Taymor was still in post-production. At the time, she was hoping for it to come out on International Women's Day, March 8th of 2020. Instead, if and when theaters reopen, it'll be out in the fall, just before the election.
And it's a powerful film about activism and motivation. So we have an enormous outreach concept that's going to start. We've already started that, where it's not just about being commercial. It's not just about going into movie theaters, which of course we want, and then eventually on television. But we want people to use this movie as an inspirational movie to get, especially young people, young women and men, not just women, to vote, to be activists, to know that, as Gloria said when she spoke at the Women's March in 2016, it's not enough to press send. That's what she said. And she's also very, you know, what's so inspiring about this woman is that she's always looking for the upside of the downside. So there's never anything dark or negative. This movie is all these extraordinary women, Flo Kennedy, Bella Abzug, Dorothy Pittman Hughes, all these women that nobody really thinks about now. I mean, the young people don't even know. A lot of young people don't even know Gloria Steinem. You know, so you're going to get in this film not just Gloria Steinem, but Barbara Jordan and the incredible characters and women who really, Dolores Huerta is in the film.
So much of when a movie or theater production takes off, it speaks to the moment you're in.
Yeah.
But one big challenge is, you know, you have to start this years and years.
We started 4 years ago.
Right. And then you kind of hope that you're in the moment.
Well, we actually, sadly, I have to say, we're more in the moment than we thought we'd be. We have so much about abortion in this movie because it was a big part of the 60s and 70s, pro-choice. The whole movement happened. Ms. Magazine had all those women signing, "I have had an abortion," in their first issue. So we had no idea that that was going to be, again, on the chopping block by the time our movie comes out.
But do you think about that? Because when you're picking what to spend your time on, you kind of have to think about what people are going to care about and what's going to make an impact.
You have to do what moves you.
What moved you in the Gloria story to use your considerable talents to bring it to others? What is it?
Okay. The very major ideas that Gloria has been developing with these other women, we are linked, not ranked. The patriarchy system is a new system. Before that, there was the circle. She goes back to original cultures. She talks about listening. You have to be in a community to change a community. Who said that about you have to be Bryan Stevenson? You have to be close. You have to have connection. We have gone so far away from that with creating, not we, but some people, creating fear of the outsider, making enemies of the other, using that to gain power. What I love about Gloria's story and the women that she is, that are part of her story, is she's one of the greatest listeners. She listens. She said, an African-American woman asks her in an interview, like this kind of interview, what would you say to black women who say that the feminist movement didn't include them? You know, that the feminine, she says, I wouldn't say anything. I'd listen. You know, there are so many things, so many quotes, so many extraordinary things that come out of her life with these other extraordinary women. You know, the word feminist has been badly used and misused and abused. But all it means is you believe in equality of women. You believe in their intelligence and their power. And what I love about this is the concept of power is so different than the concept of I never say I'm wrong, I never say I'm sorry. You know what I'm talking about.
And after the Glorias, where will we see Julie Taymor emerge next? Well, she's very excited at the moment about creating new shapes of theaters, actually new architecture.
I very much want to create theater that is of different form. And you have to get people behind you, because they're very much about, we have a footprint of a Broadway proscenium, now we can go into this theater in Minneapolis.
What form would you like?
Oh, I want to create theater that where the audience is in the center and the theater wraps around them, where film and theater is penetratable, where it's dimensional, where you mix the mediums, where you take journeys, that your space changes while you're in it. You know, they use the word submersive a lot. There is something to it, because people are so used to this tube or the phone that that it's so crazy to me that people would think that texting is more advanced than talking on the telephone. If we were the reverse, we would say that, wow, I get to hear the voice of the person speaking to me. Therefore, I'm getting a whole nother layer besides words. So I think what is very important is the visceral experiential nature of theater is something that you don't get on the internet. And it's likened to when you go into a church or a mosque or a temple and you see these extraordinary heights. What does it make you feel when you're in the spaces? You get a sense of awe, A-W-E. And that is why I believe in performance space, because being and surrounding them, the lions coming down the aisles, the elephants, people were dying, you know, they still do, and it's 22 years later. But this is something that I feel reminds people of their humanity. They can look and see, oh, there's human beings in the legs of that elephant, but it's an elephant. I agree, it's an elephant. And that suspension of disbelief is the most powerful thing a theater piece can do. I'm using The Lion King again because people have seen it. The opening of the show is a sunrise. So what I did was I took bamboo poles with silk that was ombre'd orange. Ombre means going from light to dark yellow to dark orange. And it was attached to the bamboo poles. You know, it was a big, big circle with monofilaments between the poles. It's a bunch of junk on the floor at the beginning. It's just a bunch of sticks and silk. Then the woman starts to sing Rafiki. Na-tsugonya. You know, she starts this chant, and the stagehands that you don't see start to pull, and this thing starts to rise from the floor. And the movement of rising it creates the shimmering. The light coming from the back through the silk glows. The audience knows that's just silk and sticks. It's the sunrise, the suspension of disbelief. They don't sit there and go, oh, that's not a sunrise. They go, that's a sunrise. And more to it, they're actually moved to tears by that, by the very art of it. Art has been shamed. It's been put into you can't make money on art, or art is elitist, art is this and that. Quite the opposite. Art is what makes us feel alive as human beings. Art is what makes us feel like our everyday life has another realm to it. So something as simple as a sunrise that we see every day outside, you reappreciate it. You re-see it. You see it. I use the word double event for The Lion King, because you're both being told a story and you're being told the art of telling a story simultaneously. You see a mask of an animal, you see the face of a human at the same time. So there's many double events there. So for me, the power of theater is that you can see a story from many different perspectives. You're seeing it from, it's like cubism. You know, when Picasso does a person in cubistic art, he's not putting a mirror up to the person's face. He's not taking a photograph. He's showing you this view, that view at the same time. So that's what I believe theater artists and all artists do, which is they show you your life from a different perspective. You step outside of yourself. Sometimes it reflects you, but sometimes it's not you at all.
Why is it that, for instance, a family can be, you know, one sister doesn't talk to another sister? They know that. That's their everyday life.
Right.
They go to the theater and they see on stage two sisters who won't speak. And all of a sudden, that makes them think
about themselves.
Even though they've been living this every day, what's going on?
Well, Punch and Judy is a very good example for this. People will say, Punch and Judy is the most violent puppet show ever created. And it's Punch beats up his wife, Judy, with a big club. They scream, they tear each other's heads off. And this is a puppet show for children. It's just like Hansel and Gretel or any of these things, where they're very violent. Because children are at home in very violent situations. They see maybe their mother's being beaten by the father. When they go in a public situation like that, a public experience of watching this show outside of themselves, it's an exorcism. So theater is used in that way. It's used to help kids or audiences through the darkest moments of their lives. There's a very good story in Lion King. Should I tell it to you in this one?
Yes, yes.
So during the first year on Broadway, it was impossible to get tickets. You know, it was very hard. So
people
would order them, buy them many, many months in advance. And I was told this story. I was told by a good friend of mine that this one family had bought tickets 6 months in advance, and they had two children, and during that time, the eldest daughter, who might have been around 9 years old or 10, she died. And the younger son, who was 2 years younger, you know, he was alive, and the parents didn't want to go. They were in mourning, but they were forced to go because of the younger son. So they went to see The Lion King in this dark moment of their lives. And you get to a point in The Lion King where the little Simba, young cub, asks his father, you know, basically he says, are you always going to be alive? Are you always going to be there for me? And a song has been written by Lebo called They Live in You. And the lyrics are, they live in you. This is about, see, so Mufasa, the king, the father, says to the young son, you see those stars, the great kings of the past, speak to us in those stars. They are our ancestors. They live in you. They live in me. They're watching over everything we see. So basically, you get the idea of what that's about. Apparently, this little boy turned to his parents and said, Sarah's up there, isn't she? Okay. I've done my job as a theater artist. That's it. I don't care about the money. I don't care about the audiences. I care that one child was, and a family, was lifted via the activity, the ritual of live theater, through the connection to another experience, to other people. That is the origin of theater. Theater was there, created for that purpose, to celebrate harvests, to celebrate birthdays, to actually take people through the darkest moments of death, and to make people understand that this is part of life.
There's no mountain too great. Hear these words and have faith. Oh, have faith.
Director, designer, puppet maker, and sculptor, all wrapped up in one Julie Taymor.
They live in you. They live in me. They're watching over.
She was interviewed in 2006 by Gail Eichenthal and in 2019 by Mary Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us and listening today. When you're ready for another dose of inspiration, take a look at our long list of episodes about trailblazers from all walks of life. And we'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
They live in you. They live in me. They're watching over everything we see. In every creature. In every star.
What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Until next time, wishing you peace and good health.